Good morning. Welcome, everyone. So this morning, I'm going to be talking about a case from the Book of Serenity, a koan, Chinese koan collection. And the case I'm going to be talking about today is on the front of your programs. It's an interchange between two very advanced Zen practitioners. So you can follow along with me, or follow along with your neighbor. So we have Daizang and we have Zuishan. And Daizang asks Zuishan, "Where do you come from?" And Zuishan says, "From the south." And Daizang says, "Oh, how is Buddhism in the south these days?" And Zuishan says, "There is extensive discussion." Daizang says, "How can that compare to me here planting fields and making rice?" Zuishan says, "What can you do about the world?" And Daizang answers, "What do you call the world?" Groovy, right? Okay. Where do you come from? So in these stories, where do you come from never means where do you come from. A lot of stuff usually doesn't mean what we think it usually means. And there's a lot of ways then we can interpret and enter this story. But it's designed to show us something. And this is alive for me right now. And this koan really caught my attention. I've been sitting with it for a while because of the closing line. So that's really what I want to spend my time talking about. This last interchange between these two folks. There's a group of us here right now at MZMC who are in Sesshin. We started on Friday night, and we'll be in Sesshin formal retreat, traditional retreat, until the end of the afternoon today. And so we talked about this a little bit yesterday, and it felt to me like each one of the questions and answers is raising the stakes for the previous one, and it increases its intensity and gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger until finally, at least to this heart, the hammer blow comes with, "What do you call the world? Like, what are you doing about the world? What are you doing about the world? What's the world?" Which is a really good question. A really good question. The reason this is alive for me, folks, is because I'm asking myself, and I have been asked, and I have asked others, throughout the years of my practice. This is an ancient question, but especially in recent weeks, months, years, how come I'm sitting still on a cushion when the world is on fire? How do I justify doing this when I could be doing that? Why aren't I doing something about the world? Does that feel relevant to you? Does that kind of make sense, right? This is not a new question. We did not just invent this. This is ancient. This is old. Contemplative practice has always been under a certain amount of scrutiny because it appears to be passivism. It appears to be non-engagement. It appears to be unconcerned with the matters of the world. You know, you go up to the mountaintop, right? You go off to the monastery, and you leave the things of the world. You leave the red dusts behind, as we say in Zen. And so surely there's a wisdom to that. But there's a tension between contemplation and action. There's a tension between safety and exposure. There's a tension between refuge and engagement. Right? Isn't this kind of the human condition? We talked about this a little bit yesterday, and we talked about the two different broad categories of meditation technique in Buddhism, what we call shamatha, relaxing, centering, calming, easing, pain reducing, coming home again. And vipassana, insight, exposure, digging, searching, going down, going up, you know. And these to me feel like just fundamental human energies. The part of me that wants to stay home where it's safe. The part of me that really wants to know what it feels like to be at the top of Mount Everest. You know, we are that species. We get to do both of those. We have very powerful drives to want to stay, and we have very powerful drives to want to go. I want to be safe, and I want to explore and grow and change and evolve, and I want to stay home, and I want to go out. You kind of get it, right? It's a very human sort of energy. What can you do about the world? All right. Well, let's start the conversation there. What are we talking about? What do you call the world? What do you call the world? Let's talk about this. So, the former president of San Francisco Zen Center's name is Zesho Susan O'Connell. She's a Soto Zen priest. And she gave a talk on this koan. And part of what she said was, time and again, during question and answer sessions after a Dharma talk, someone will ask, what is the use of just sitting in Zazen when there is so much suffering in the world? This question is usually meant as a challenge to what seems a kind of passiveness. It is true that the world is full of suffering beings, humans, animals, plants. Even the planet itself is deeply suffering. Shouldn't we be having extensive discussions, protesting, implementing solutions? This koan does for me what I think is the intention of all koans. It stops my mind in mid-stride. It brings my awareness to the importance of asking questions before acting. Questions like, what is the nature of suffering? What is its ultimate cause? How can I help a world that I see as separate from myself? Wouldn't it be more beneficial for me to deeply understand how the world is not something out there that needs saving? If I consider the way we are all constantly, every moment, making the world, then each simple, ordinary action that I am able to take right here is doing something about the world. And when it is time for other kinds of action, less simple or potentially more widely impactful action, it is my intention that these actions will be grounded in not knowing what the world is and not knowing what helping is. Wow, I think that's great. She takes it to a place there at the end that I would not have expected. I said this a little bit yesterday to the group, like, you kind of figure she's going to spend time going, why don't we examine the cause of suffering, the nature of how it arises, how we all co-create the world, and then become really, really clear and know very clearly what the world is and what helping is before we do it. And she says exactly the opposite. Let's make sure if we're going to go out and do something, we have no idea what the world is and what helping is. It makes no sense. Unless you're a Zen student and you've been hanging out at places like this for a long time, and you kind of start to see where she's going. Because how dangerous am I if I know exactly what your problem is and how to fix it? I know. I've just become a very dangerous person, haven't I? Potentially, anyway. Potentially. I've become an expert. You're separate. Something dangerous. Potentially. Very dangerous about that. What do you call the world? So that's a pretty well-known koan. That's a pretty well-known koan, and there's a lot of stuff going on in it. There's a complementary case starring these two same folks. Case number 42 from the book of Mega Serenity that goes like this. One day, Dai Zhang was roller skating, and he fell and skinned his knee on the sidewalk. He was tending to his knee when Zuishan approached him. Zuishan said, I can see that you are hurt. Why aren't you caring for yourself? Dai Zhang said, I am. Zuishan said, no, you're not. What about the head? What about the ankles and spine and toes and nose and ear hair. How can you ignore them? You are only caring for the knee. And Dai Zhang replied, right now, the knee is me. Okay, so I made that up, you guys. There's no such thing as the Book of Mega Serenity. I'm just trying to tell you the story in a different way that's a little more easily accessible. My suspicion is they actually did a lot of roller skating in Chinese monasteries, but it stayed unrecorded. It was just too cool for people at that time. They couldn't handle it. So what is eclipsing my experience right now? What is eclipsing my experience right now? What is eclipsing my experience right now? Do you kind of get where I'm going with this? What is eclipsing my experience right now? I know that you are in pain because you're a living being. It's the first noble truth of Buddhism. To be born, boom, too late, guess what now? You're going to struggle. You're going to resist. You're going to constrict. You're going to wish things were different. You're going to, we call it suffering broadly, but we know what this is, dukkha. So I know that's true about you. I also know I've made a vow. I have a deep aspiration that's built into the DNA of my consciousness itself to act in accord with your suffering and do something that will alleviate not only your suffering, but my own. That's actually my hard wiring. Despite the fact I'm very defended against that impulse, it's actually my hard wiring. So what is the thing that is most likely to get in my way? My own unaware suffering. That's what's going to get in my way. That's what's going to get in my way and prevent me from seeing yours, accepting yours, understanding yours, and being present to yours. Which is why so often the front lines of the world and the work of compassion for the world is right here. It has to be. It has to be. So Zen teaches us there is only mind. There is only mind. All we can know, all we can ever know, is mind. For us to see joy arising in mind is to see it. For us to ignore joy arising in mind is to ignore it. For us to meet and hold joy arising in mind is to meet and hold it. There is only mind. For us to see suffering arising in mind is to see it. For us to ignore suffering arising in mind, or distract, or defend, or repress, or suppress, or turn away from suffering arising in mind is to ignore it. But for us to meet and hold suffering arising in mind is to meet and hold suffering. That's it. That's it. Where is self there? Where is other? Where is me? Where is the world? There is no separation in that equation. All I am aware of is mind. When suffering arises in mind, can I see it, accept it, hold it, care for it? Can I? That's it. There is no other front line. Right? We're talking about moment, the contents of moment. We're not talking about past or future. They are contained here in moment. This is it. There is only mind. There is only this one experience. So there is either me meeting it or me not meeting it. It's meeting it or not meeting it. You sort of see how we get in our own way about this, right? We just do. It's okay. We're humans. We get in our way about this kind of stuff all the time. We invent the other and then we create a separation. Now I'm looking at me. I'm caring for me. That's selfish. There are others. What do I do about that? What do I do about that? My imagination is like a snake that's turned back and is biting its own tail. So when we are doing Zazen, when we're doing meditation, or when we're in line at the co-op, or when we're in traffic, or when we're having that conversation with our child or our parent or our spouse, or we're watching the Wimbledon finals, which I'm not watching because I'm here. And I notice the arising of suffering. I notice the arising of suffering in this heart mind, right here. And it's called boredom, frustration, I don't know, constriction, grief, resistance, irritation, whatever. It might be a 1 or a 2. It might be a 9 or a 10. It might be very, very subtle. It might be really gross. Boom. If I choose to ignore it, defend against it, distract myself from it, kill it in some way, I'm turning away from, distracting from, and killing the suffering. The suffering. I don't get to say it's mine. I don't get to say yours is yours. This is Buddhism. There is the suffering. There's just the suffering. There is just the suffering. For me to turn away from it is me turning away from it. For me to turn toward it is to turn toward it. It's to turn toward the suffering, to turn toward it, right? With open arms, to try to do something, to try to understand it. The reason this is incredibly important, why I'm repeating this over and over, is because there is only one suffering in your life that is immediate. That you can feel in your bones, in your muscles, in the constriction of your heart, in the racing of your thoughts. And you call it yours. Go ahead, fine, call it yours. Just don't ignore it. Because it is the suffering. And it has a unique, special quality when you compare it to the imaginary suffering that you can't touch or feel or directly contact with your heart mind. There is nothing about that suffering that is arising in your consciousness that is abstract or distant or later or separate. There's nothing separate about your suffering. It's right there. It is already for you specific. It is immediate. It is intimate. It's so non-separate you wish it was separate, right? That's what we do. And so it is the suffering. It is the suffering, just as real as we imagine others' suffering to be. But if we leave our suffering untended, our personal suffering prevents us from seeing the suffering of the world, from understanding it, from accepting it, and engaging with the suffering of the world in a way that's actually helpful and actually healing. The front lines is right here. So I gave these session participants a handout yesterday, which is, I think, probably against the rules. So as long as Ted isn't around, I'm okay, because he... Oh, no! Why didn't you guys warn me? You could see him sitting there. Come on, do me a solid back there. It's probably against the rules, right, to do a handout? I gave out a handout. I don't think you're supposed to do that, are you? Today you're all getting a phone book. Okay. So, I'm joking, of course. We just don't do much reading. We don't do a lot of reading and writing in Zen retreats. In fact, none. But I had a handout anyway. I'm a great fan of the handout. Speaking of which, when you leave today, there's a handout. there's a handout for all of you on the porch. It's a poem. I'm going to read at the end. It's a gorgeous poem. Please take it with you. It's fantastic. I'm a great fan of the handout. It's because part of me, like when I go to something and do something, I want a souvenir. I just do. I don't know why. Probably because like my very first baseball game I went to when I was like 5, I got to take home like a little wooden bat. And I was like, the game didn't end. I still have it with me. It says right on there, Harmon Killebrew. And that had like magic powers. I'm like, well, then everything I go and do should have some sort of souvenir. You know, when you come home from work and you've got something, a pile of stuff to do, that's like pretty crappy souvenir, but it's true. And you go home from school and they all pin this note to your jacket, sweetie, and then you can take that home. It's like a souvenir. Anyway, we should have souvenirs, you know, like baseball caps or Zen Center mugs or I don't know. Okay, I'm trying to give a talk. What is wrong with me? My handout was just 3 koans, the first of which we're talking about. What do you call the world? The second one is also from the Book of Serenity. It's very, very well known, and it's about tending the sick. Dawu tends the sick, it's called. It's about the practice of visiting, the spiritual practice of visiting those who are ill. And the conversation is about, so who'd you visit? Which, again, from a Buddhist perspective, is a great question, a very relevant question. Oh, I was out tending to the sick. Oh, who are the sick? Right? There's like 7 billion of us. And so there's this little play back and forth about what's the sick, what's not the sick. You know, again, these are just people playing with words trying to figure out what this looks like. And then the third koan was about the nature of compassion itself, the nature of compassion mind. It's a koan folks who have been spending time with Zen know really, really well. The one about why does Kuan Yin have so many hands and eyes, you know, reaching back for the pillow in the dark and noticing that the nature of awareness itself is compassion. It isn't an affectation. It isn't something we add to our outer layer or learn. It isn't a skill set. It's the nature of consciousness itself is to be compassionate, to meet the tending of the sickness of the world, the suffering of the world, with compassion immediately before we even think about it. How do you care for the world? You care for the suffering that's in front of you. The suffering that's in front of you. You care for the suffering that's in front of you. What other suffering can you care for? It's the one that's right here. Here you go, here you go, here you go. And oftentimes, it's yours. I'm assuming, right? I mean, you guys are humans. Isn't it often yours? Isn't that usually the most immediate one that eclipses the most of your experience? Your own fear arising, your own insecurity, your own anger, your own clenched heart, your own shallow breath when you get activated. Hello, that's the suffering showing up. Here it is. How will you tend to the sick person that's right there? The scared person who is right there, the insecure person who's right there. Suffering that's calling out for your attention, right? We all know what it's like to suffer, and we all know what we want in that moment, right? Don't we want to just be understood and cared for instead of lectured to or criticized or judged or explained? Oh, my knee. I skinned my knee when I was roller skating. It hurt so much. Oh, yes, I can see how many layers of skin you have pierced there. I can see what you do. You know what you might want to... No. You know what you need to do is like what Mom did, which is let's clean that up, sweetie, and put a Band-Aid on it, and then I'm going to kiss the Band-Aid. That feels a lot better to me. And then maybe later on you can talk to me about the layers of skin and the nature of injury and what's the difference between being cut and being bruised, and you can tell me all about da-da-da. And the truth is when our own suffering arises, we generally dismiss it with criticism. We generally dismiss it with explanation, or we demand of it. This is one of our favorites. When strong emotion shows up, we actually look at it and go, how come you're here? Like, what's your deal? What's your deal? I'm really scared. I got to give a Dharma talk. I'm super, super, super scared. Well, how come? That's a stupid thing to be scared. Well, you've given a million of them. Why are you scared? Why is it worse now? Right? It's like telling your, you know, three-year-old nephew, no, there's not a monster under your bed. There's no such thing as monsters. Go away. Like, no. No, that's not how you engage with that. No, you don't argue. With it, you just see the suffering that's there. Go, oh, you're scared. You're scared. And as a grown-up, you can see that the narrative around the fear is different than the fear. You can see really clearly the narrative is false. No, there isn't a monster under your bed. But I sure can see how real your fear is. I hope you don't think you've outgrown that. That's what we do all the time. The thing that you're super, super scared of next week or a year from now is just like the monster under the bed. Forget it. It's not that big of a deal. No one's going to die. Your fear is horribly out of proportion to the actual thing, which means it's about something else. And if you just argue with the narrative and tell yourself, there's no monster under the bed, go back to sleep, you're not helping it at all. You're not helping it at all. You're avoiding it. Of course you're avoiding it because you don't want to feel the suffering. Like humans don't want to experience suffering. I get it. We all do this. That's why we come to places like this. Oh, how lucky we are. It's why we have traditions like this, why we have Dharma friends, why we have centers devoted to. What would it be like if we just sat still? What would it be like if we just faced the thing? Wouldn't that be kind of nice, actually, the thing you've been running from? There's joy under there that's finally allowed to bubble up, some contentment, but it'll never bubble up if you keep running. What would it be like to just meet the arising experience with acceptance and curiosity and kindness, just kindness? That's how we tend to the world. So when I was born in Golden Valley, I'm pointing that way because I'm imagining that that's north. Is that actually north?
Yes.
Hot dog. I'm pointing that way because I know for a fact it is north. So I'm born in Golden Valley, and so when I was born, I inherited that hospital bed. First place I was, right? Ta-da! Welcome to Earth, hospital bed, right? I inherited that hospital bed. I was born into that hospital bed, right? And also that hospital room and also that hospital. And also Golden Valley and also Minneapolis, the metro, right? Also Minnesota. I also inherited the United States. I also inherited my parents' karma, their genetic tendencies, their eye colors, skin colors, bone structure. I also inherited my parents' parents, my parents' parents' parents. I inherited human. I inherited all of it, just like you did. Right? When you were born, you inherited all of it. I actually like thinking about it that way. You inherited all of it. All of it is your birthright. All of it is your birthright. You inherited all of it. So when I'm looking for the roots of my particular suffering, as a Buddhist practitioner, as a Zen student, I look at the mind very, very carefully. I sit still and I don't do anything other than look very carefully at the mind. And I try to find the origin point to my suffering. And if I'm thorough enough, I will see that it goes back infinitely far. And this idea I have of my suffering, which is the common idea, and then this other idea that Buddhists offer of the suffering, stops being an abstraction. Because yes, I have my suffering, and I can see its roots going back, and I can see some of my tendencies physiologically, mentally, emotionally, culturally come from my parents, and my culture, who inherited it from their parents and their culture, who inherited it from their parents and their culture. Oh my God, I didn't invent this. In fact, the more closely I look, the less me is there. The closer I look, the less my suffering there actually is, and the more the suffering there is. Do you sort of see the progression? So if you ask yourself this on the cushion, and I think it's worth asking, I notice that I'm cranky, right, about whatever it is that I'm cranky about. Spend a few minutes seeing if you can find the origin of that. Like, where does it actually start? In time, where does it start? When did it start? Your predilection for orneriness didn't just get invented today, right? The thing that irritated you, this isn't the first time this has happened. How far back does it go? Can you find the origin point? You will notice that you're unable to figure out, I hope, this is your experience. If you look really closely, you'll see, I can't actually answer the question if my suffering started with a particular thought or a particular emotion or my own particular unique psycho-spiritual soil that nourished the seeds of delusion and affliction in my own consciousness, because I didn't invent that soil. I inherited that soil, and that soil came from something else. It inherited from something else. It inherited from something else. It inherited from something else. I get it. It's the suffering. And this is the form it's showing up in today, right now, for me on this cushion. That's pretty abstract. So recently, for my birthday, I was given one of those DNA kits. I forget the company, but you know one of those deals where you swab the inside of your mouth and you send it in and it tells you, oh my God, you're way weirder than you thought you were, you know? Do it, it's cool. It's very, very cool. And I learned, oh, yeah, you've got way more of this than you thought, and you've got some pieces of North Africa in there you didn't know about, and there's some weird thing that maybe China, but we're not sure because it's less than 1%. I don't know. You're a mutt, dude. And da-da-da-da-da. And so here's what's neat about that is, okay, so your ancestors came from Minnesota, and before that Wisconsin, and before that New York, and before that Ireland and North America, and then before that Northern Africa, and then there's a whole mix before that we know it gets really, really blurry, right? It's kind of cool to just sort of think of part of yourself going back. What was interesting about this experience for me was I did it at the same time my wife was doing it, and so we're comparing notes, you know, to figure out whether or not we're compatible, essentially. Like, oh, you're from there? Whoa. Let's talk. where our conversation went was like, we ultimately didn't, and they probably explained it, but we didn't bother reading the fine print. Like, I kind of don't get it. DNA isn't based on country, because there's no such thing as country. We're making those things up, right? I mean, you've driven across to Canada. There's no actual line there. We made it up. So, like, well, hold on a minute. If I've got a whole bunch of Ireland in my roots, how come my roots go back to, oh, because they come from, oh, right, that means you're actually Viking. Well, that means you're actually, right? And then we also realize it only goes back so far. It only goes back so far. So when I was in South Africa, this was, I don't know, 5 years ago or something, last time I was in South Africa, we went to a place called Meropeng. It was very, very close to the Sterkfontein Caves where they found Miss Pless and Eve, the earliest earliest Homo sapiens, are there in South Africa, right? The origin of the species. In fact, they call it the cradle of humankind. It's very, very cool. It's extremely cool. I'm not going to talk about it at length because I'll start crying. It's extremely cool. So we went to this really neat natural history museum in Meropeng. And as you're walking in, there's all these signs you pass, you know, because you're going to this natural history museum. It's essentially about the history of us, right? And one of the signs outside the museum said, "We are all African." And so when my wife and I are getting these results back for this DNA thing, I thought, well, you know, it goes back far enough to go, oh, yeah, you've got this sort of thing, and there's that unique culture and that kind of stuff. But I realized that's like the most recent history version of this is when we really start to differentiate. And the idea of race is sort of vaguely there, which is utterly made up, but we have this sort of idea. There's genetic features and this kind of stuff that shows up there. But we all know that if you trace that back far enough, we go back to that cave. We go back to that cave. So I inherited that when I was born in that hospital bed in Golden Valley. Did I not? Did I not inherit Sterkfontein Caves? Did I not inherit that? Exactly the same way I inherited my family's skin color and penchant for god-awful music and alcoholism and tendency to repress feelings and blah, 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 blah. The stuff that I'm very close to. Oh, yes, I inherited it from my dad. He was just as stubborn as I was. I'm kind of proud of it. Ha, ha, ha. Right? That's my inheritance. I got that from my dad. All the way back. Same with my suffering. God, I'm stubborn. I'm always making people cranky because I'm so stubborn. Oh, I got that from my dad. Yeah, so part of the stubbornness I'm experiencing is my dad's. That's true. Keep going. Keep going. Keep going. Keep going. Is it still yours? Is it still yours? How far back do you have to go before my personal ego grip on that being mine starts to loosen and I go, oh, I get it. Humans suffer. I walk upright and play with tools just like Mrs. Pless. I get it. I inherited all of this. So if my bodhisattva vow is to meet suffering with the transformative fire of compassion, where does that start? Later? With you? Outside? Over there? In the past? When right now I'm sad? When right now I am angry? When right now I am grief-stricken or resentful? It's right here. How am I not working on the project? It's the project. It's the project. It's like when you went and saw Incredibles 2, you know? And like, here's the animators. You go, yes, the director. That's the one who made the movie. And then 20 minutes later, they're still showing the credits because there's like 80,000 people. And they did the accounting. And they did the one. I'm like, you know what? They're exactly as responsible for this bad boy as that first name. They're part of the thing that created this thing. So I can't get to go to the accountant and go, why, you're only the assistant accountant. How come you're not helping to make the movie? It's like, I am. But you're not in the studio pointing those... Well, they don't have actors. I picked the wrong movie as my example. You get where I'm going, though, right? You're only doing math here in this cubicle. I'm working on the movie. I'm working on the movie. How come you're only holding your skinned knee, Dai Zhang? I'm caring for myself. What about your hair and your ears and your crazy... I'm caring for myself. This is me right now. This hurts right now. This is me. It's not abstract. It's not later. It's direct, and it's screaming at me, and it's crying at me, and I'm caring for it. What do you call the world? All right. So, one of my recent heroes, and I'm going to wrap up here in a minute. One of my recent heroes, and when I say recent, I mean the last like 3 years, he showed up, sort of showed up on my radar. There's a man named Howard Thurman. Some of you will know that name. He was a famous theologian. He's a Baptist, Southern Baptist theologian. He was Martin Luther King's spiritual director. How much of a rock star job could you possibly have? At least in my universe. This is not a rich person, but I'm like, you're Martin Luther King's spiritual director? Oh! That's like, oh yeah, you know, Gandhi, I'm the one who taught him all this. So, yeah. I just want to stay in the DL, but yeah. Anyway, he is amazing. His writing is beautiful. He was giving a commencement speech at Spelman College that is now very, very famous. Look it up. It's called The Sound of the Genuine, Howard Thurman. A commencement speech at Spelman College. It's gorgeous. It's just gorgeous. And one of the things he was saying was, because he's a contemplative. He's a contemplative. I would argue he's a mystic, but I can become quiet enough, still enough, to hear the sound of the genuine in me. I can become quiet enough, still enough, to hear the sound of the genuine in you. Notice the order. Now, if I hear the sound of the genuine in me, and if you hear the sound of the genuine in you, it is possible for me to go down in me and come up in you. So that when I look at myself through your eyes, having made that... Hang on. Oh, pilgrimage. Sorry. Having made that pilgrimage, I go down in me and I come up in you. Having made that pilgrimage, I see in me what you see in me. And the wall that separates and divides will disappear. And we will become one because the sound of the genuine makes the same music. This is a beautiful piece. If you replace the sound of the genuine with suffering and compassion, you have, in a nutshell, the Mahayana Buddhist understanding of what suffering is and what compassion is and why it's not the enemy, why it's the place of connection. When you have a heartbreak and I have had heartbreak, we get to talk because now we know one another in a way that's way more interesting and way more intimate than exchanging information about where you worked and how long you've worked there and what you think about this horrible weather. I go down in my heartbreak and I come up in your heartbreak because the sound of the heartbreak makes the same music. And the same with joy and the same with contentment and the same with bubbles. We talk mostly about the difficulty because that's what Buddhism's here to address, right? But the same dynamic works for joy, too. We talked yesterday about how this is why we somehow feel compelled as a species to get together if we plan on being super happy. I'm not sure what that is. We use the example of a wedding, like, those two fell in love. I can't believe it. They fell in love. They're going to get married. And there's something still inconceivable about a wedding. It's hilarious. Two things are going to try to become one thing. That's amazing. It makes no sense whatsoever, and it makes perfect sense. We all go, that's the map. That's the map of the universe. Two things become one thing. And then, right? It's the union of opposites. Some part of us just goes, oh my God, I get it. This is actually non-separation. Like acting itself out right in front of me. Non-separation. This makes me so happy. I'm so happy for them. We should all get together. We should all get together and create a container big enough for me to hold this feeling because holy buckets, I'm going to cry. It's a wedding. Wow, it's a big feeling. Let's get together and hold it. I'll go down inside my joy and I'll come up in yours. And you'll go down inside your joy and you'll come up in mine. And the same thing with funerals. I'm wrenched. I'm grief-stricken. I'm lonely. I'm scared. So are you. Let's get together. You'll go down in your grief, and you'll come up in mine. And I'll go down in my grief, and I'll come up in yours, even though he was your dad, and he was only my neighbor. Or he was my brother, and he was your cousin. Not so different. Not so different. If you go into your own suffering, you will find the suffering of others. That is true. If you allow yourself to go into your joy, you will find the joy of others. It's what Zazen is for. To peel the layers of personality and ego till we get down to the bedrock. The fundamentally human experience. Breathing, walking, eating. Feeling joy, feeling scared. Feeling hopeful, feeling sorrow. There's no separation in those places because everybody knows that. It's where we find love. That's where we find it. All right. I made it halfway through my notes. That's pretty darn good for me. That is pretty darn good. I thank you very much. And so I'm going to close with this poem. And it's the one I hope that you can take with you today. We're not going to do questions because we're in retreat today. But I will offer you this poem because it's just a much shorter, much more graceful way of saying what I just spent 40 minutes saying. It's a poem by Naomi Nye. She lived during the 40s and 50s here in the United States. She was Arab American. And she just wrote a poem called Kindness. Kindness. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go. So you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then, it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for." And then it goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. Thank you, Naomi Nye. And thank you all.